that time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
Welcome to the Cold War, episode 191, Ray. The Korean War part something. Korean War part 2, episode 3. Or 1.
Wow.
1. So episode 2.
Right.
2. Korean War part 2, episode 2. Because we did one episode last time, I think, after the Richard Lim debacle. Which I'm still getting emails about, by the way.
Oh, well. Live and learn. I wouldn't. Just a wave on the ocean.
Yeah. Korea hangs like a lumpy phallus between the sprawling thighs of Manchuria and the Sea of Japan.
That's true, actually.
One of my favourite lines from William Manchester's biography on Douglas MacArthur,
right?
Which I got to tell you is a great read. It's funny. It's one of these books that has been sitting on my bookshelf for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think I picked it up, you know, in my early 20s when I started to get interested in history, and I probably skimmed it, but never sat down and really, really read it. Right. I've been reading it this last week, and fuck me, that guy can write. He's like the Tacitus of modern history stuff.
He's awesome. He takes you for a ride. Yes.
Korea hangs like a lumpy phallus between the sprawling thighs of Manchuria and the Sea of Japan. Like,
quite lumpy phallus. Why not? Anyway, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Is there another kind? Is there another kind? I don't know.
I'll let you know. I'll take matters into hand and I'll let you know. I don't know.
So we're going to talk a lot about MacArthur for the next couple of episodes because he's now the man in the hot seat. But an hour after Truman's announcement of the American military commitment to Korea, Congress approved a bill extending the draft by 314 votes to 4.
Damn.
The draft. They're extending the draft over Korea. Not going to fight the Nazis, not going to fight the Japanese.
Right.
It's over Korea, a civil war, and a country which about 2 weeks earlier various senior American politicians had been saying was not really important to the United States, wasn't part of their strategy.
Yeah.
Now they're extending the draft, forcing.
Right.
Let's be clear on what the draft is.
Yes.
It's forcing through threat of violence your citizens to go to war.
It's the state protecting itself at the sacrifice of its own citizens.
The draft, like it's one of these Barry and Stan masterpieces. We just call it the draft.
Right?
It's just the draft. It's like a draft.
Yeah, it's like a lottery.
It's a cool breeze coming in under a door. Do you feel that draft?
I do.
It's nice. Yeah. It's refreshing. A draft is refreshing.
That's it.
Unless it's a cold day and you go, where's that draft coming from? But let's call it what it is.
Right, right.
It's you're forcing your citizens to go to their deaths.
Yeah, or to kill, at the very least, to try to kill other human beings.
You're forcing your citizens on the threat of violence. Now, you're not going to execute them if they don't go, but, you know, the punishment for avoiding the draft, jail. Yeah, you're locking them up if they avoid the draft. Yeah. Or if you're Muhammad Ali, you know, you lose your heavyweight championship belt.
Right.
So it's a threat of legal punishment if you don't go and try to kill other people and or you know, put your own life on the line. And this is happening in a democracy that it, well, fuck me. Did you see what Biden said after his Putin meeting?
No, I missed that.
Fucking your president, Democratic Great White Hope.
Right. Right.
Said, I don't have the exact quote here, but I can find it on my Facebook in a minute. But because I posted a thing about it, he basically was talking about Putin, and he said something like, "Here we go.
Mm-hmm.
How would it be if the United States were viewed by the rest of the world as interfering with the elections directly of other countries?"
Maybe he's a comedian. Maybe Biden's a stand-up comedian and y'all just weren't getting the tone that he was laying down, because that statement is absolutely ridiculous.
What would it be like if we engaged in activities that he engaged in? It diminishes the standing of a country. Motherfucker, we know. I had Dove Levin on this show a couple of years ago,
right,
who did an extensive report that demonstrated that the United States, let me pull up the figures here, the United States intervened in 81 foreign elections between 1946 and the year 2000, while the Soviet Union or Russia intervened in 36. A 2018 study by Levin found that the electoral interventions determined in many cases the identity of the winner. The study also found suggestive evidence that the interventions increased the risk of democratic breakdown in the targeted states. Yeah. Biden, though, it's two-part. Number one, Biden gets up and has the temerity to say what he said, A. B, he didn't get immediately laughed at by the journalists. I want to do a version of the presser where he says that and then there's a pause and then just the entire bank of reporters just, break out in laughter. Good one.
Good one.
Nice one.
Five.
Come on, President Biden.
Oh, you're killing me.
Nice one. Yeah.
Somebody throw a shoe at this man.
Are you fucking kidding me? And like the supposed leftist media in the United States just hasn't just gone apeshit going, "What the fuck are you talking about, you dipshit? We do this day in, day out."
Yeah.
You did it in Ukraine. You personally overthrew the government of Ukraine.
He was bragging about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my take. We can meddle with countries for decades in the dozens. We're the good guys. We're trying to make the world a better place for us. Russia was messing with us. That's the no-no. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. So they're the bad guys. They're the bad guys.
Do as we say, not as we do.
How long has Putin been in charge? 20 years?
Yeah, give or take.
Something like that, okay. That's a lot of elections. But the point is, Biden should not have said that, because that's exactly what we do, and we spend billions of dollars. I don't know how much, we spend a lot of money doing it, and people die.
I saw somebody on Twitter in response posted the front cover of Time magazine from like 1990, whatever it was, with a picture of Boris Yeltsin on it, and it was all about how America got Boris Yeltsin elected.
Right.
And, you know, three cheers for us. We determined the president of Russia.
Yeah. That's not meddling. That's
and, of course, you meddled to get Boris Yeltsin elected.
Right.
And then when he left, he gave power to Vladimir Putin. So America really got Vladimir Putin in the position of power. Anyway, it's
so we created
story.
The jihadist extremists, and we put indirectly Putin in charge. Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
And created ISIS. Just anyway, let's move on. So the point I want to make here is the draft here is a pretty brutal thing to have in a democracy, but it doesn't get talked about a lot. It's one of those things that we just go, oh, yeah, it's just the draft, right?
Yeah. Yeah, the draft in this country is, it's kind of like race relations. We know they're there, don't really feel comfortable talking about it. Pray to God we never get, you know, when you're in that zone, that age range, it never happens to you. As far as the Korean War, I think I found this somewhere. 1.5 million men were drafted versus the 1.3 million that volunteered. So that's a lot of people to take up off the streets. And so congratulations, you are now fighting for democracy, you American hero, son of a bitch. So... yeah.
You know, whenever you're talking about World War II with particularly Americans, you often hear them go, well, sure, Stalin helped defeat the Nazis, but that's just because he forced his people to go and fight them. Like, he just threw bodies at it.
Yes.
He forced people with threats of violence to go and, shoot at the Nazis.
Or die.
Called the fucking draft, motherfuckers. You had it in America, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
On June 30th of that year, 1950, obviously this is like a week and a half after,
June 25th.
Okay, so it's 5 days.
Right.
On 30th of June, the military assistance program for Korea passed the Senate by 66 votes to zero. My point with all of this, apart from the draft, is that American politicians loved it. Couldn't wait to get involved in another war in 1950. Well, let's go! Get it on!
We genuinely saw ourselves, and maybe I should be more objective and say, the Americans at that time saw themselves as truly standing up to communists in some ways for the first time. Like, we're really going to do this. There's been a lot of talk and there's been a lot of speeches and articles and books, but this time we're really going to stand up to them. And here's what we're not going to do. We're not going to fucking have another China on our hands where we spend all this time to try to adopt this country, take them to our bosom and lose them anyway. No, we are going to defend democracy.
Could you do that movement again? I like the way you mimed that to the bosom. You're like, you really got into that. You really committed to that.
Well, what is the type of acting where you literally become method acting? I was method.
Yeah. I saw that. Wow. Yeah. It was crazy to me, like how you just went straight into character there all of a sudden. That was like Pacino-esque, man. That was astounding.
I do have to say this real quick before you go on. You're going to get into this, so I won't ruin anything. But all of this is going to be put in MacArthur's hands. He's not a perfect person. We'll go into all that. But I wrote this line down about Truman and the administration better watch out, because MacArthur is not a team player. Not unlike Tony Stark, he is only interested in pleasuring himself. So again, we're going to find out this guy's got a massive ego. And you've
heard, what's he got to do with Tony Stark?
No, just because
does he like to jack off?
They both like to play. Whatever pleased them was good. Mm. Anything else was bad. But MacArthur, that's like times a thousand. And we're going to see that.
Do you think Tony Stark ever jerked off while in the Iron Man outfit? Did he have like a nanotech?
Yes. I know he had the scrubbers and the cleaners. If he didn't, he was an idiot. I'd be flying high and literally flying and jerking off all in the suit. I mean, that's Christmas.
Did you think he had a nanotech flesh? What do they call them?
Fleshlight
built in. Yeah.
If not, you've just improved that suit.
Why not?
Suit. Yeah. Oh, you've just improved that suit. Yeah. Yeah. It's got rockets, but does it got a flashlight? Huh? Yeah. I'm not interested. Yeah.
Meanwhile. While all this was going on in Congress, General Douglas MacArthur, living in his little palace in Tokyo, was actually considering retiring from the army and taking a job as the chairman of the board of Remington Rand, the typewriter manufacturer who, the next year in 1951, came out with the Univac line of mainframe computers. They'd offered him a $100,000 salary in 1950 to take the job as chairman of the board, which is a do-nothing job. Like, you just go play golf most of the time, basically turn up to a board meeting every now and again, which would have been a massive jump on what he was getting as general running Japan and running Asia, the emperor of Asia, basically, what he was at the time.
Yes.
On the 31st of May 1950, just before all of this went down, I read an interesting story. Mm-hmm. He banned a communist rally in Tokyo. Now, for people who don't know, look, I don't know how many people outside of America, particularly people, you know, younger than us, really know much about MacArthur and his role. But, you know, he was ruling Japan time there as like a literally. Like a... What would you call him? Like a shogun. Potentate. He was the shogun. Of Japan. They were the United States was occupying Japan, and he was ruling the place basically as his own personal fiefdom. Mm-hmm. On the 31st of May 1950, a couple of weeks before this went down, he banned a communist rally in Tokyo, which was being organized by the Tokyo People Democratic Front Preparatory Committee.
Right.
They had 100,000 people who were going to turn up. They were protesting the occupation of the country. But he banned it because it conflicted with the U.S. Army's Memorial Day services that were happening on that day.
Right.
So yay for freedom. Hey, we bring you freedom, but you can't have a protest because we're going to have our own little celebration that day. And yes, this is Japan, but U.S. Memorial Day services take precedence
in your country
over the Japanese people protesting your occupation of their country. Eight Japanese were arrested for beating up five American soldiers during a protest about the banning of the march.
Right.
But I thought this was interesting just to show that not all Japanese people were submissive to the U.S. occupation.
Mm-hmm.
There was a communist, active communist organization over there.
Right.
Because you do read lots of stories in Manchester's biography and that kind of stuff about how the Japanese people kind of loved MacArthur because he wasn't as harsh on them, they thought, as he could have been, as they probably would have been if they had been the victors. They were
during the war. Yeah.
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 You know, their approach was far more brutal. He was, and I'll get into some of the details on this, he was brutal on one hand in some ways, but also quite lenient in other ways. He's an interesting guy. But some of the Japanese people loved him. Like, there's lots of stories of that. He was like treated like as a celebrity by some Japanese people.
Right.
But there were also others that were furious that they were being occupied, as they still are. There's plenty of protests going on in Japan to this very day, furious at the continued U.S. occupation. What did we say recently? You got 50,000 troops there,
something
or something?
Like
I think.
Yeah. You think they'd be used to it by now?
Might be in Germany. I mean, it's in both.
Yeah.
American troops used to it by now.
You would, two generations. I mean, get over the,
I'm not sure as of now, but according to Wikipedia, there's about 50,000 US troops still in Japan.
Yeah.
And they go, well, it's not an occupation. No. We're just, we're helping you make the right decisions.
Right.
Let's just put it that way.
You're welcome.
You know, we you made some bad decisions once.
Right. Never again.
And we don't want you to do this. So we're here to help.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
they want us there. I love it when guys like Markham will say, well, no, listen, you know, you ask them, they want us there. Yeah. Yeah. Sure they do. Yeah.
I know the
the
pimps of the hookers want us there. I don't know about anybody else. But just real quick, and I won't ruin any of your stories from MacArthur, but I just want to give that some context. So MacArthur was a celebrity in his own mind. Very regal, took himself way too seriously, always trying to outdo his father. I won't ruin anything. But basically, when he comes to Japan, the Japanese, and you said this a second ago, the Japanese are like, you know, considering the things that we've done, they're going to bust our ass and we're never going to be an industrialized nation. Because remember, Morgenthau wanted to take Germany, carve it up into like five different things and turn it into a bunch of farmers. The Japanese thought that that was going to happen to them, but even worse. So MacArthur comes in, and because he's so regal and he takes himself so seriously, and he's actually, like you said, a celebrity, it's only someone with his aura, with his dignitas, that can actually even come close to the Japanese emperor that the Americans allow to obviously not die, be hung, or anything like that. So it took someone as regal as MacArthur to come in, scare the shit out of the Japanese, because they didn't know what to expect. But like you just said, he made them redo their constitution, get rid of their army, change some things. But then again, he did take it easy on them. And pretty soon by 1950, they're running themselves. He's still there. He's still got his troops. He can do whatever he wants. He can override anything. But the Japanese are up and running as far as the government. So it takes someone with his prestige to walk that fine line between I'm going to punish you, but we're also going to take care of you, because guess what? You are now a partner in the Cold War with, you know, against China and Russia, and they're right over there. So that's why we're there. But a lot of the people in Japan held him in awe. And like you said, there was a smaller percentage of people that wanted him and the Americans out. But when you lose a war, you don't have a say. And so that's why we're still there today. But the point is, there was a lot of people who were impressed with him, like the Americans, and thought he was capable of handling any great task. And now here's a great task for him to handle.
What was that quote? If you lose a war, you don't have a say.
You don't have a say. Motherfucker.
Hmm.
And that's reality. Well, I'm sure the Geneva Convention doesn't word it like that. But when you lose, you lose.
For all time. That's it. You have no say in anything. Leave. No rights.
Until my troops leave, bitch.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The Japanese were scared. They were like, you know, America could do something, like, if they wanted to, they could do something really, really brutal, like drop two nuclear bombs. Oh, right.
There's always a third.
They did.
Bitch.
Do they?
There's always a third. Yeah. Anyway.
Now, from his appointment running the Korean operation in June of 1950 until he was finally fired by Truman. Mm-hmm. 10 months later.
Asked to leave.
MacArthur's view was that it was the historic destiny of the United States to destroy communism on the battlefield.
Sure, sure.
Not, let's pit our two economic systems separately against each other and see who survives.
Which people are happier.
Communism had to be destroyed.
Yes.
And it was his view that it was America's monopoly on nuclear power that was going to enable him to do that while it lasted. And they had to make the most of that monopoly while it lasted, because eventually the communists would catch up. They'd already caught up, but he didn't really know that at the time.
And it's also his destiny. It's not just America's destiny. It is his personal destiny to do this. He is the hand of God, the right hand of God.
And he literally kind of believed that he was the tool of God. Yeah. He was a rabid Christian.
Yes.
There was a great quote I found in the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph.
Right.
This is from July 17th, 1949, a year earlier, where somebody was being interviewed by somebody in Tokyo, part of SCAP, was being interviewed in Tokyo by this journalist, and he said, "General Douglas believes that God spoke to Moses, but he knows that he speaks to MacArthur."
Yeah, Moses might have been right. I don't know, but let me tell you why. I talk to the big man every Monday morning when I'm on the crapper. I know what I'm talking about here.
MacArthur believed that, this was now a war, as did most of the American leadership at the time.
Right.
It was a war between American Christian democracy and atheist communists. Yes. That was the big battle. This was a religious war in the mind of MacArthur, I think it was with, you know, a lot of the American political and military leadership at the time. Walter Lippmann, famous journalist and political influencer that we've talked about many times, wrote that it was hard for Americans to feel secure in a world not governed by Christian concepts.
I can see that. I mean, it's sad. It's a sad commentary, but I think it's true. I think it's still true today.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to understand when we're looking at the Cold War, and, you know, we've How many years have we been doing this show? We've gone over this so many times.
Yeah.
But this was, in the minds of Americans, a religious war. It was Christians versus
the godless,
dirty atheists. Yeah. It really, when you boil it all down, it was a battle between, well, it was the American elite and the British elite and the Australian elite, whatever, worrying that if our people decide they want communism, then all of our wealth and power goes away. We can't allow that. Right. Secondly, it was the church leaders getting behind that, going, well, you know, if communism becomes popular, religion goes away, we can't have that. Right. So it was framed in the minds of many people as a war of, it was a religious war. It was a it was a jihad. It was a Christian jihad against the atheists.
Can I just say real quick, if you could go back in a time machine and go back to 1950, and it's not unlike the war, the story we did, the war on drugs, to go back to the 50s and 60s and to talk to some old white guy in his 50s or 60s or whatever, and he knows beyond anything that marijuana will kill you, it will make you go insane and you'll probably stab someone. I mean, for these people, and that's the same thing with the religion and the Christianity and our way versus the communists. I mean, they knew it down in their bones. They knew it was absolutely true, and there's no way you can convince them otherwise. And so with that kind of, I don't know if you want to use the word passion or fervent belief or whatever, but now you've got this threat in Korea. So for them, truly their entire existence is now being threatened. So they are on board, and they're just very thankful that they've got someone like MacArthur, who their champion, who got him through one tough spot, and now he's going to get him through for another. But this, for these people, that's all that stuff you were just talking about that you and I laugh about. For them, it was absolute gospel. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just find that amazing.
Now, MacArthur, when you read biographies on him, they talk about him being a 19th century kind of a guy.
Yes. Yes.
He's kind of like, yeah, he saw himself very much like a Napoleon or even a Caesar. I mean, Manchester's biographer on him is called American Caesar.
Exactly.
Also the name of a great Iggy Pop album, by the way, if you've never heard it. Really good album.
Oh, you need to get Chrissy to call you Podfather, like MacArthur had his wife and everybody call him the General. Just fucking, good morning, General. How are you, John? This is his wife. Chrissy needs to show you some fucking respect. And I'll tell her. I'll fucking tell her. No, I won't tell her. I'm afraid of Chrissy.
Mm. Anyway. Me too. Yeah.
You too.
You know, what he really believed his mission was right, to defeat Muscovite adventurism, as it was referred to in one book. And he would have felt that way whether it was the communists running Moscow or a czar running Moscow or mandarins in Peking versus the communists.
Doesn't matter.
It was this 19th century idea of the grand chessboard, dividing it up. America's manifest destiny is to rule the world, and he was put there by God to enable the United States to do that.
Right.
He also didn't believe in the concept of limited war. He was a big believer in Thomas Aquinas's view of a just war. In Manchester's biography, he says that MacArthur believed that if the battlefield was the last resort of governments, then the struggle must be waged until one side had been vanquished. It's not just
like a Nazi.
Yeah.
Total war.
Total war, and not just defeat the other side, but the total obliteration.
Yes.
Wipe them from the map once and for all.
Yeah.
I want to read the opening of Manchester's book because for people who haven't read it, sit down, strap yourselves in, because this is just fantastic. He was a great thundering paradox of a man, noble and ignoble, inspiring and outrageous, arrogant and shy, the best of men and the worst of men, the most protean, most ridiculous, and most sublime. No more baffling, exasperating soldier ever wore a uniform. flamboyant, imperious, and apocalyptic. He carried the plumage of a flamingo, could not acknowledge errors, and tried to cover up his mistakes with sly, childish tricks. Yet he was also endowed with great personal charm, a will of iron, and a soaring intellect. Unquestionably, he was the most gifted man-at-arms this nation has produced. He was also extraordinarily brave. His 22 medals, 13 of them for heroism, probably exceeded those of any other figure in American history. He seemed to seek death on battlefields. Repeatedly, he deliberately exposed himself to enemy snipers. First as a lieutenant in the Philippines shortly after the turn of the century, then as a captain in Mexico, and finally as a general in three great wars. So let's just point out there that he was part of the invasions and occupations of the Philippines and Mexico.
Yes.
So, again, part of the whole manifest destiny, literally on the front lines of manifest destiny.
Yeah.
At the age of 70, he ordered his pilot to fly him in an unarmed plane through Chinese flak over the length of bleak Yalu. Nevertheless, his troops scorned him as Dugout Doug. His belief in an episcopal, merciful God was genuine, yet he seemed to worship only at the altar of himself. He never went to church, but he read the Bible every day and regarded himself as one of the world's two great defenders of Christendom. The other was the Pope. For every MacArthur strength, there was a corresponding MacArthur weakness. Behind his bravura and stern Roman front, he was restive and high-strung, an embodiment of machismo who frequently wept. He yearned for public adulation. His treatment of the press guaranteed that he wouldn't get it. After World War II, he was generous toward vanquished Dai Nippon and executed two Nipponese generals whose only offence was that they had fought against him. He emerged from the 1940s as a national hero in Canberra, Manila, and Tokyo, but not in Washington, D.C. He loathed injustice and freed Filipino patricians who had collaborated with the enemy. He refused to send an expedition against the Hakbalahap insurgents on the grounds that if he were a Philippine peasant, he would be a Hak himself. Continuing his sidestepping to the left, during his years as American viceroy in Japan, he introduced the Japanese to civil liberties, labor unions, equal rights for women, and land reforms, which were more thorough, in the opinion of Edwin O. Reischauer, than Mao Tse-tung's. Meanwhile, he became a cat's paw for reactionaries at home. The army was his whole life, yet at the end of it, he said, "I am 100% a disbeliever in war." In his campaigns, he was remarkably economical of human life. His total casualties from Australia to VJ Day were fewer than those in the Battle of the Bulge, but his GIs, unimpressed, continued to mock him cruelly. His paranoia was almost certifiable. He hated an entire continent, Europe. Europeans could not understand why. I mean, listen, fuck me. I mean, that's probably the greatest opening to any biography I've ever read, I got to say. Yeah. Like, it's just, that's magnificent writing, right? I mean, and he sounds like a fascinating, fucked up guy.
Yeah. And if I could just react, oh my God, there's so much I want to say, but if I could just react to one thing that you said or that you read, and you probably can answer this better than I can. I don't agree that MacArthur was fearless. He was, if you didn't know any better, fearless. He was very brave. He did put himself out there, even when he was an old guy in World War II, is a little halfway over. He still exposed himself to danger. But I really do believe that it wasn't courage so much as in he was so in love with himself and he was so sure that he had a great destiny that it wasn't his time to die. So it didn't matter that he exposed himself in World War I or in the Philippines or World War II. It wasn't so he wasn't going to die just because of his belief in himself. And as Max Hastings writes, maybe there was... either way, whether you agree with it or not, it got him through those moments. And it did impress the hell out of some people. So was he brave? I don't know. But there's also a good chance that he was just so sure of his destiny that he couldn't die, that he risked his life anyway, just knowing nothing bad was going to happen to him. That's not normal.
Well, it reminds me of Napoleon mm-hmm. and Caesar and Alexander. We've talked about all these guys who all did the same sort of thing and yeah. would expose themselves to danger while their soldiers were trying to pull them back and stop them. Alexander going over the wall and getting a fucking 3-meter arrow in his lung. Right. Caesar wearing his red cape
on
the battlefield,
Come
his general's cape. Yeah. Napoleon crossing the bridge. You know, these guys did that, and I think in every one of those cases, it was the same thing. They believed that they had a destiny.
Right.
And that it wasn't their time, and they were right until it was their time. Alexander died right. young.
Yeah.
Caesar died younger than he should have. Caesar didn't even want a bodyguard. Don't need a bodyguard. Yeah, if they want to kill me, let them kill me.
Yeah.
So they did, and he was like, oh, fuck. Why didn't I have a bodyguard?
Oh. My bad.
But it's kind of survivor bias, right? It's yeah. like, you know, when you read stories, and I have these conversations with my son Hunter all the time.
Right.
Like, you know, he's, because he wants to go to Hollywood and be a big famous actor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I go, well, you kind of need, yeah, that's great and you should do that, but you should have like a plan B. And he goes, no plan B. Yeah. Look at Schwarzenegger. Yeah. He said he had no plan B. These guys. I go, yeah, you're talking about the ones that had no plan B, the 0.001%
exactly.
that had no plan B.
Exactly.
And, you know, were lucky enough to pull it off. The other 99.9999% that said they had no plan B and are now waiting tables, you know,
yeah.
it's survivor bias, right?
Would you like to
you're
see
only
my
looking
headshot?
At the ones that survived.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
if MacArthur had felt that it wasn't his time to die and had been killed in the Philippines
right.
or in Mexico or wherever, then
yeah.
we would never know his story.
Exactly. So I'm not trying to take away from the man. He was more of a symbol than an actual great warrior. We don't have to debate that because this is not the show about that. But it's important to know his flaws. And like you said, one flaw is that he believes in total war. The other flaw is once war is joined, the two swords are crossed, the politicians need to get the fuck out of the way. It's for the general to decide everything that happens because it's a war. The general's in charge. When the war's over with, your politician's going to be in charge. Now, as you can imagine, Truman's not going to be crazy about that. And we can go into that later, but Truman's got very limited objectives. MacArthur's got God on his side. So there's no such thing as limited objective. So he's going to go balls to the wall and it's going to piss off a lot of people. Let me know when we can talk about the hookers. That's the only reason I'm here tonight. So
yeah.
Yeah. Just the other side of MacArthur that makes him human. That actually makes me feel, you know, a little sad for him, but it shows his flaws.
Yeah, the hookers, and I wanted to talk about the suicide.
Yes.
So he wasn't mentally well.
No.
There's a recent American study of MacArthur that revealed some details that weren't previously known
right.
about his private life.
Yeah.
When he was the chief of staff for the U.S. Army before the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of threats of committing suicide, lots of prostitutes, although...
Right.
Platonic. He liked having platonic relationships with prostitutes.
Yeah. Stroke my ego.
And I'll let you talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
You know, during bouts of depression,
mm-hmm.
he would call prostitutes up to his suite and then get them to tell him what a great guy he was.
Yeah.
Sounds very Trumpy, really, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But in Michael Schaller's biography of MacArthur, The Far East in General, one of MacArthur's aides, T.J. Davis, T. tells a story about he was on a train journey across the US with MacArthur at one point. MacArthur was going on about suicide. He said, as we pass over the Tennessee River Bridge, this is MacArthur speaking, as we pass over the Tennessee River Bridge, I intend to jump from the train. This is where my life ends, Davis. Mm. Davis replied, happy landings.
I'm calling you bluff, motherfucker.
Yeah. And it says, MacArthur got the message and never talked about killing himself again. So talk to me more about prostitutes, Ray, your favorite topic.
Thank you very much. Well, yeah, prostitutes and farm animals. But the point is, this guy needed his ego stroked.
I believe it. Right. Preparation for this show, you did a lot of research.
I did do.
With prostitutes, you had to bring them in. Yes.
And try the farm animals.
Yeah, it's method. It's method acting. You had to get method acting.
Method research.
I need to understand. I need to understand MacArthur
exactly.
from the inside.
Yeah.
Can you come into my hotel room and tell me how wonderful I am?
Let's just say when I do research, I go balls deep. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's not really a long distance, but the point is it's long for me. It's all relative. It's all relative. I don't want to talk about it anymore. But no, but actually, Admiral Yamamoto.
Speaking of a lumpy phallus. Yeah. What?
Admiral Yamamoto, who planned, generally speaking, Pearl Harbor, the attack, he would also spend time with geishas, and they would sing him songs, and they would laugh at his jokes or whatever. But that was just him having a good time because he was married to someone he didn't love. I didn't get that sense with MacArthur. Literally, MacArthur would talk and they would be amazed by him. They would laugh at the right time. They would ooh, ah, or whatever. And he just basically needed a massive ego stroke. Now, maybe after all that was done, he went and whacka, whacka, whacka. I don't know. But the point is, when you on a, even if you just do it, say, seven times, I don't know, you hire a hooker and you, no, keep your clothes on. I just want to talk about how great I am and I need you to nod in all the right places. And I'll get off on that. We don't need to touch. I mean, that just tells you there's something going on in the guy. There's something missing, but he constantly needed that validation. And that's why he was such a performer. He would purposefully carry himself a certain way, interact with people, talk a certain way. He was trying to impress everybody constantly. I don't know about his mother, but I do know that he had daddy issues. His daddy won a lot of awards and did a big job, had a moment of heroism in the American Civil War. He was always trying to outdo his dad, but almost like Alexander, that times a thousand. And so he was a very complex person. There was a lot of good in him. There was a lot of weak points, but now he's 70 years old. He's already been through what should have been his defining moment, surviving the Philippines attack. And now he's got to do it all over again with Korea, and he's now 70 years old. And is he going to be able to pull it through again? Because the American people certainly thinks that he can do it.
One of the things I didn't really understand about MacArthur is how much of a narcissist he was and how he saw himself as like really standing above everyone else. Like the rules were made for, the rules didn't apply to him. The rules were made for lesser men. He was a god amongst men.
Right.
I'm going to read more from Manchester's book. It may be said of MacArthur, as the Durants said of Napoleon, that all the qualities of Renaissance Italy appeared in him: artist and warrior, philosopher and despot, unified in instincts and purposes, quick and penetrating in thought, direct and overwhelming in action, but unable to stop. Tocqueville put it well. He was as great as a man can be without virtue, and he was as wise as a man can be without modesty.
Perfect.
Most of all, however, MacArthur was like Julius Caesar, bold, aloof, austere, egotistical, willful.
Yeah.
The two generals surrounded themselves with servile aide-de-camp, remained long abroad, one as proconsul and the other as shogun, leading captive peoples in unparalleled growth, loved history, were fiercely grandiose and spectacularly fearless, and reigned as benevolent autocrats.
Yeah.
They were also possessed of first-class brains. Sophisticates in the last quarter of the 20th century are disdainful of military intellect, but great captains have always been men of genius. Goethe thought that Napoleon's mind was the greatest that the world had ever produced. Lord Acton agreed. That century rated warriors higher than this one does. Walt Whitman wrote, "Knowest thou not there is but one theme for ever-enduring bards, and that is the theme of war, the fortune of battles, the making of perfect soldiers." Bonaparte's analytical gifts and his phenomenal memory were recognised in his time as signs of his massive cerebral powers. MacArthur matched them. The man who wrote the Japanese Constitution, like the creator of the Napoleonic Code, was clearly a prodigy. His knowledge of history and law was astounding, and he never forgot anything. Once he reminisced, blow by blow, about a boxing match he and a visitor, reunited with him after 47 years, had watched the evening that they had parted. Meeting John Gunther in 1950, he picked up the thread exactly where it had broken off of a conversation they had held at their last meeting in 1938.
Damn.
He knew the history of every Japanese unit he faced in the field, where it had fought in China during the 1930s, its role in the conquest of Malaya, the reputation of its commander, and intelligence appraisals of its morale. During a planning conference for the invasion of Honshu in 1945, a briefing officer said that the surf on a certain beach was treacherous. "Certainly," the general said. "I remember seeing it when I came out to Japan with my father in 1905. Then he reeled off tidal details. The incredulous officer, checking them, found them correct in almost every particular.
That's impressive. Oh, and just to add to it, if anybody needs just another element to help you picture MacArthur, he was someone who was very, I won't use the word anxious, but very energetic. He couldn't sit still very long. He had to pace. He'd love to pace. Even when he was making his great escape from the Philippines, from Corregidor Island, he ended up pacing in the little torpedo boat and the plane that he was in. So he couldn't sit still. He had this favorite worn down house coat that he wore with his slippers, and he would just pace for hours. But don't get me wrong, while he was doing that, he was thinking. But just picture someone who's got tons of energy, who can't hold still, and he thinks he's the greatest thing since sliced bread. The problem with all this is, like we said earlier, you've got a democracy, the United States. You've got Truman, who wants a limited war. Look, I just need you to push the bad guys back over the line. After that, stop right there. And MacArthur's pretty much, and he didn't hide this, he's pretty much, "Yeah, that's not how I roll, son. I kick ass all the way. I put my foot all the way up their ass, because that's what God wants me to do." So as you can imagine, there's going to be a lot of tension between MacArthur and his civilian boss, Truman, and we know who's going to win that one.
Now, I want to talk about his pipe.
Okay.
Do you know the story about his corn cob pipe?
I know. I tried to put a picture of him with it on Facebook, and it got banned for promoting smoking, but please.
No, really? Really?
I had to find a picture of him without the... So anyway, I'm like, Jesus H. Christ. Anyway, tell me about his pipe.
Yeah. Well, he famously used to, you know, always be seen with this corn cob pipe. It was made by a company, and it's still made by a company called the Missouri Meerschaum Company.
Oh, nice.
Based in Washington, Missouri, the corn cob pipe capital of the world.
imagine.
It's been around for over 150 years, still housed in its original 1884 red brick building.
Not bad.
MacArthur had been a longtime fan of corncob pipes and actually designed his own.
Of course he did.
With all the schematics and
like,
sent it.
Like Leonardo, right?
Yeah, yeah. In his downtime,
right?
He sent the schematics to this Missouri Meerschaum company, and they made it for him based on his own schematics.
Wow. Of course they did.
So that's why he would always be seen in photos with it, because he designed it himself.
Very proud of it. It's not just a pipe. Yeah. It's my pipe. I'm the creator.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So there you go. There's a letter I've got in front of me here that he sent to the vice president of the company. This is dated 10th of March, 1959.
Right.
"Dear Vice President Otto, thank you so much for sending me the pipes. It was thoughtful and generous of you, and I deeply appreciate it. With the passage of time, I find each year brings increased enjoyment and satisfaction from my corn cob pipe." with best wishes, most sincerely, Douglas MacArthur.
Right.
Yeah, so they would send him, he had a whole like collection of right. these pipes, and they would send him free pipes all the time. So there you go. I want to try one.
Yeah, why not? So Nelly the rapper had a Band-Aid on his face. MacArthur's got the corncob pipes. Same thing. Everybody's got their shtick.
Napoleon had a hat.
Had a big hat.
Hitler had the Charlie Chaplin mustache.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. So, let me just ask you something real quick. Based on all the, I know you did a ton of research to write your book, Psychopath Economy. When you hear MacArthur only had people on his staff, I'm sure they were competent. That's not the problem. But he only had yes men on his staff. He would never have anybody challenge him. He would never tolerate, whether it's his wife, his kid, his subordinates, whatever. But when you hear someone, if you take the name MacArthur out and, hey, there's this guy, pretty smart, pretty intelligent, pretty energetic. He's capable of doing pretty good things. However, bit of a fragile ego, and he cannot stand insubordination or someone standing up to him or pointing out a mistake he made. What's your kind of take on, based on what you know about MacArthur now, just someone who is afraid of having someone in the room who might even come close to being on his level intellectually or maybe willpower-wise? What do you think of MacArthur in that sense?
Well, look, he comes across definitely as a narcissist.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't get the sense that he's a psychopath.
Right.
Although I think at some level, people sending other people to their death organizing the mass slaughter of people on a battlefield probably do need to have a bit of psychopath in them. Look, you know, I get the idea that in a war situation, mm-hmm. if I was thrust into a war, then, you know, I would kill to protect my family and sure. protect my home and my loved ones and my friends and that kind of stuff. You don't have to be a psychopath to go to war. You don't have to be a psychopath to kill, to be somebody who's really good at it
right.
and who devotes his life to it. I do think you need to be a little bit, at least at some level, high up on the psychopath scale. Mm. But, you know, from, you know, the biographies that I read on him, his ability to be magnanimous and, you know, to fight injustice and to do some of the good things that he did.
Right.
Like, the not good, but, you know, the benevolent things that he did, particularly when he was running Japan.
Yes.
I don't get the sense that he was a complete psychopath. Definitely a full-on narcissist,
right.
though.
Gotcha.
You know, he's the classic narcissist, yeah. like a Trump. You know, just needed adulation,
yeah.
right? He just, I was reading an article this morning about Trump. I think in The Economist or something, talking about Trump and what's going on in Mar-a-Lago with him now. Apparently everywhere he goes at Mar-a-Lago, he goes to the dining room, people stand up and applaud. Everywhere he goes, he gets applauded by people in Mar-a-Lago.
Right.
Go ahead. Michael Cohen, his former lawyer, was quoted in this article as saying, Trump needs adulation like the rest of us need oxygen.
Yes, God.
Like and that sounds like MacArthur, right?
Yeah.
He needed that. He needed to surround himself with yes men and prostitutes.
Just real quick, if you ask Trump, hey, can you tell me of something you remember from 40 years ago? You know, because you just were talking about MacArthur's intellect and his memory. I guess Trump would go, yeah, there was one time, I remember it was 43 years ago, it was on a Saturday, and so far you're impressed. You're like, there was this cocktail waitress, and she had a tattoo, or was it a mole? It was really cute. It looked like the shit of Florida, which is why I moved there, right here on her hip. Sexiest thing in the world. That's what I remember. Business, family, when my children were born. No, but I can look that up. That's fine. I can look that up.
Yeah, James Caffin on Facebook this morning said that he's not a big fan of MacArthur and he reminds him of Trump. And I think that's the big difference between these guys. Like, both narcissists,
right.
yes, but MacArthur seems to have had a brilliant intelligence.
Up. Yes.
Prodigious memory, brilliant intelligence, very well read, very knowledgeable about history. No one's ever mistaken Trump for being knowledgeable.
But.
Or well-read.
I read today Trump was talking about maybe, possibly, he might write the book of books. That's an exact quote. I always assumed that was the Bible. clearly I was wrong. So hopefully he will put pen to paper.
He is going to write the Bible again. the new Bible. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
MacArthur, as we said before, ran Japan like his personal kingdom.
Yes.
His office was in the Daiichi Insurance Building. And I know you've been a little bit Daiichi recently. You've had to see a doctor.
When I'm not regular.
About it. Yeah. Of your lumpy phallus has been Daiichi. The Daiichi Insurance Building was situated across the road from the Emperor's Palace, could keep an eye on him.
Damn right.
It had somehow survived the firebombings of Tokyo during World War II. His office was and still is on the sixth floor of the Daiichi Building.
Right.
It remains there today untouched. Because the Japanese are scared that if they touch it, America will nuke them again. So they're not going anywhere near it. Apparently that's what MacArthur told them. You fucking, when he left, you fucking touch one hair in this office.
Boom!
Big boom boom. Big boom boom.
Boom boom,
that's
come back.
That's all I have to say.
Right, right. Yeah, we
boom,
are.
Boom boom, come back.
We're horrible.
Boom boom, come back.
Same with my backup singers, Ray and the Boom Boom Come Back.
You no touchy touchy, Boom Boom Come Back. He was a racist piece of shit, basically. MacArthur, that's what I'm saying.
Just real quick, I know we're busy. I don't know if we're over time, but the Audible book version of Max Hastings, it is read by the guy, an English gentleman who I absolutely love. The most clipped, arrogant British accent that you could possibly imagine. I love it though. But the point is, when he does,
it's not actually Max Hastings.
No. Because he's done a ton of books. When he does voices, or when he says a line that's someone who's Asian or Indian or American or whatever, he'll do the best he can with the accents. But he's so bad at it, I just assume he's a flaming racist. I have no idea, but he'll just do these outrageous accents in Japanese. I'm like, dude, I don't know when you recorded this, but that's not cool anymore. Cancel culture. You can't do that. But anyway, if for those of you who don't have time to
the book's not that old.
Huh? No.
The book's not that old.
But trust me, the guy who reads it does a brilliant job. I absolutely love his voice.
Do you know what his name is?
He has his real name, obviously, but then he has the state, for lack of a better word, a stage name when he reads the books. I used to know it. I don't know it anymore. Shit.
Cameron Stewart.
Sounds like a racist. No, I guess that's either his real name or his reading name. But the point is, I definitely encourage you to check out Max Hastings' audiobook version. You will absolutely love it cruising down the road.
Why would he have a stage name? A lot of them, narrator.
A lot of the readers do that, yeah. Or at least they did back in the 90s and the early 2000s. I don't know about now.
Right.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
I'll check it out. So, yes, you can still go visit, I think by appointment only, but you can go visit MacArthur's office. And a friend of mine here in Brisbane told me that he has MacArthur's desk from his Brisbane office when he was in Australia. He has it in his house.
Did he steal it? He is Aussie. He's an Aussie.
This friend of mine's a barrister, like a lawyer.
Right.
His father was a very high-profile lawyer and I think member of parliament part of the government here.
Right.
Might have been the minister, the justice minister something like that here. And apparently his father was a big fan of MacArthur's, and when MacArthur left, somebody gave Dez's father MacArthur's desk.
I got to check that out.
And it's still sitting in his house. I offered to buy it. I said, how much do you want for it? And he just laughed at me. Anyway.
Yeah. We're going to go visit.
He's probably snorted too much coke off of it anyway. It's just got white lines all over it.
That's
so
more valuable now. Anyway. Yeah.
Anyway, by 1950, as we've said, MacArthur was 7 years old. And I think one of the important points to understand here, he was used to being treated as a king.
Yes.
He was used to being treated with deference, particularly when it came to military decisions. As you said before, his view was, once it was war, He was the boss. That's right. Get the fuck, off. No one argue with me.
Just fuck right
I'm the. Right. Yeah, this is now my domain.
Yes. Yeah.
He would get into work at 10 a.m., leave at 2 for lunch at home.
Right.
Come back around 4:30.
Yeah.
And then work until late in the evening, 9 o'clock or even later. Never took holidays. Never took time off. But 70, not taking time off. No weekends, no public holidays. Didn't take time off. He was a workaholic. Again,
yeah.
Reminds me of Napoleon. Right. Used to work around the clock, never took breaks off. I remember I was telling stories about Julius Caesar.
Yes.
At some gladiator trials at the games.
Fucking working.
Dictating. Working. Yes. And people were booing him because he was working at the games.
Like, fuck.
Didn't have time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm trying to run an empire here. You try it sometime, bitch. Yeah. Do you remember? I remember Stalin's hours during the war, but Churchill had similar hours. Churchill would stay up until late, get up around noon, eat breakfast in bed, read the newspapers, finally get up and do some stuff, but he would stay up late. Where Stalin during the war wouldn't go to bed until 5 a.m., got up at 10 a.m., and then just did the whole thing over again. So just very driven, high-energy, focused people who didn't believe in fucking wasting weekends and holidays just get to the work. And they probably loved, to a degree, they loved what they were doing.
They loved their
work. If that makes sense. Yeah.
On the 27th of June... he sent a military reconnaissance party from Tokyo, led by Brigadier John Church.
Good name.
An American officer.
Right.
From Japan to South Korea to check out the military situation there. They were met at the airport by the U.S. ambassador, John Muccio, taken to a nearby school where they were debriefed. And according to one of the officers who was there in the meeting, they were told by the Americans and South Koreans that... the location of the enemy forces was unknown.
Is that important? Do I need to know that? Is that a big deal?
You would think, yeah. The very same day when the South Koreans and Americans were telling Church that the location of the enemy was unknown, the enemy took Seoul.
Now we know where they're at.
The North Korean People's Army, the NKPA, or the Inmingun,
right,
as they sometimes were referred to, the Inmingun, the IMG, they took Seoul. Now, they were meeting in Suwon, which is the region where Seoul is.
Right, in that area.
They still didn't know. They could have just looked
stick your head out the
and
window.
Seen them.
Do you hear that sound?
The point is... This is... several days after the North crossed over the 38th parallel, and they still, like the South and the Americans that are there, still have no idea what's going on.
No.
They're completely clueless. Don't even know where the enemy is. When they're taking the capital, they don't know. They don't know what's going on.
They'll figure it out.
The next day, more U.S. aircraft arrived, some carrying ammunition, and minutes after they left, the airport tarmac was strafed by North Korean planes.
Yes.
And then not long after the North Korean planes left and stopped strafing the tarmac,
right,
MacArthur landed.
It's because Jesus is looking out for him. Go ahead.
On his private jet, the Bataan, which he named after his greatest failure.
You're not wrong. Or the way he looks at it, the great reversal of fortune. No, you're right. It's a fucking... Anyway, I was going to try to spin that. But yeah, literally some two American planes were strafing the enemy troops, land, jump out, head into headquarters. Then their planes get strafed. Those enemy yaks take off, a single-seat fighter. They take off. And within minutes later, MacArthur lands with a whole bunch of press. So clearly Jesus, or Jesus, as MacArthur called him, was looking out for this guy because he could have died right then and there. But nope, MacArthur's landed, and now he wants a report.
Just for people who aren't familiar with the Battle of Bataan, do you want to give a quick high level on how it ended up?
Oh, God. Okay, you know, not only will I do that, but I will make MacArthur look bad. So before the war, the American Pentagon, not the Pentagon, the Army Chief of Staff said, if Japan attacks, there's no way we can keep the Philippines. There's no fucking way we can hold it. So we're going to pull everything out. We're going to regroup around Hawaii, yada, yada, yada. MacArthur, he gets a job, a long-term job by President Quezon, gets paid a shit ton of money, goes, I want you to build me an army. So MacArthur comes, he brings his staff, and right away MacArthur's staff is going, this country doesn't have enough money, resources, infrastructure, that you cannot build a modern army. We need to get the fuck out of here if Japan comes. But MacArthur's like, no, I think we can do it, just because the Philippine troops have coconut helmets and they're barefoot and they've got rifles from before World War One. I think we can whip the Japanese. So he convinces the Pentagon, if war comes, we're going to stay and fight. So now he's got roughly 80, 90,000 men. They're trapped. The Japanese come. The Japanese whoop ass because they control the skies. They control the sea lanes. You get the American, mostly Filipino, but a few American units trapped on Bataan for months. And from like January to April, they absolutely starve, barely eating anything. MacArthur's on Corregidor Island. He's not eating much either. I don't want you to think that he was just picking out. But as things are about getting very bad, he only visits Bataan once. MacArthur normally is the kind of guy who would be there by your side in the foxhole, encouraging you. But for whatever reason, he only visits Bataan once during the siege. And then he makes a big deal out of it. And my personal opinion is that he forced Roosevelt to order him to leave, because he's like, I'm not leaving. I'm going to die with my men. If they die, I die. If they get captured, I get captured. And FDR is like, we can't have a fucking general get captured. That would look horrible. So I order you to leave. I think MacArthur knew that was going to happen, which is why he was being brave the entire time. But the whole thing was a clusterfuck. And when MacArthur left Manila to go to Bataan, he forgot to take several million bushels of rice that would have lasted for years. So
Okay. You're going into way too much detail.
Sorry, he fucked up.
I said high level.
I've done like 10 episodes so far, so that was high level. Anyways,
80,000, like 80, roughly 80,000 yeah. troops surrendered to the Japanese, yes. American and Philippines, and went on the Bataan Death March.
Yes.
My point is, yes. It was a colossal failure.
Oh, huge.
And then he names his private plane yeah. the Bataan.
And his staff was called the Bataan Gang. He would not let that yeah. go. He would not let yeah. that go. But
I love it.
He
saw it. I mean, that's...
He saw it as a great escape. You and I see it as a defeat. He's like, no, I got out of there. I got a bunch of troops and men and ships and planes, and I came back and whooped ass. I'm fine.
I'm good. I'm fine.
Yeah, look.
I got out.
Yeah. Yeah, hey. Yeah. I even gained a little weight, you know, because he did lose like 20, 25 pounds for a while. But he's like, no, I'm good. What are you bitching about? Oh, those 80,000 people.
I didn't have to march anywhere.
Starved to death.
Yeah.
Are you going to put that on my record?
I just love the temerity of like a colossal failure like that, and then trying to turn it into.
He was obsessed with controlling the narrative, which is why the American people loved him, because they didn't fucking know any better. He's like, I will do this. I got this. I will handle this.
Yeah. It's like Trump. Yeah. No, I lost. Yeah. I won. I won the election.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I won. I don't care about the facts. I won. That's it.
There's no way. There's no way I could lose to this guy. So ergo heretofore. Yeah. I won.
Yeah.
Anyway,
MacArthur lands. He gets met by Muccio Ree, and Church gets taken to another school where he gets briefed. Then, for 8 hours, he drives a Jeep through the battlefield.
Fuck it. I'm MacArthur, bitch.
Yeah. All right. Let me go have a look. See what's going on.
Would you drive me? Fuck you, sir. I'm not going to drive the Jeep. Yeah.
Actually, I like the fact that before he left Tokyo to fly there, he was meeting with journalists, and he said, I'm going to be at the airport at 8 o'clock in the morning. If you're not there to come with me, I'll just assume that you had more important things to do. Yeah. It's fine. And they were like, no, we're going to be there.
The biggest story.
And he's like... Yeah. He said, I'm just giving you an out or something like that. Yeah. I was just giving you an out if you didn't want to come. Yes. It's fine.
Yeah.
You get a little bit. Anyway, he drove back to his plane and told the 14 American officers that had gone over with Church, the recon outfit, to stay behind to put some backbone into the Koreans.
Now, can I just
the quote
real quick. so you bring your, you bring part of your staff with you. And as you're leaving, by the way, you guys stay here and help with the fight. You would think, he might've said, bring a toothbrush, a second pair of underwear, whatever medications you might be taking, backup glasses. Yeah. But it was dramatic. You guys stay here and put some backbone into the Koreans. I'll go back. I mean, just fucking over the top Saturday Night Live hero shit. But he loved it. And but of course, his men had to struggle for a while because they had none of their stuff. It had to be flown over. But he loved gestures like that. It made him look cool.
And he flew back to Tokyo. And I just want to finish now with another quote from Manchester, because this is great. The situation in Korea was Orwellian. A former ally of the United States, the Soviet Union, was championing a captive state, North Korea, in a conflict in which the South Korean foe was being supported by the United Nations, to which the Russians belonged, while the Soviets, meanwhile, were demanding the right to participate in treaty negotiations with a former enemy of the Americans and the Russians, Japan, which would bring peace between Japan, which was becoming the base for anti-Pyongyang forces, and the United States, now the Soviets' arch enemy. So,
my eyes crossed.
Yeah.
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 That is the situation at the time, and where we'll leave this episode, unless you're going to complain and want to jump in there.
No, just somehow MacArthur had to please the Pentagon, the UN, Truman, and the South Korean people. Other than that, easy, easy.
Easy.
The curtain has descended across the continent.